From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
What does that mean?
It talks of Parikarangaranga. She was the wife of Kupe, the great navigator. They'd named our country.
Today, a journey into what it is to be Maori. Also, a conversation with British MP George Galloway about U.S. and British policy towards Iraq. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The leaders of eight industrial nations concluded their annual economic summit meeting on the island of Nago, Japan, with a broad commitment to help poor countries reduce their debt burden and increase their access to better education, health care, and information technology. In a communique issued at the end of a three-day meeting in Okinawa, Japan's southernmost island, the leaders of the Group of Eight promised action on a wide variety of issues, most notably to curtail extreme poverty and the spread of infectious diseases like AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. This is Japanese police have released four members of the environmental group Greenpeace who were arrested while protesting the rich country policies at the Group of Eight summit in Okinawa. The four activists were arrested on Friday after sailing an inflatable boat to the beach resort where the world leaders were meeting. The four members, a woman from Israel and three men from the United States, Japan, and Russia, had been attempting to deliver logs from Russian forests and a letter to G8 leaders to highlight Greenpeace's campaign against what it calls illegal and destructive logging in ancient forests. Japan's largest power utility said today it has shut down a nuclear reactor after discovering an oil leak 2 days after an earthquake forced the shutdown of another reactor at the plant. Tokyo Electric Power Incorporated was quoted by Kyoto News Agency as saying 300 liters of oil leaked from through a crack in a duct. The oil was being pumped to a valve to control the flow of steam from reactor to turbine. The news comes amid growing public uneasiness with the industry in Japan, beset with accidents in recent years, which has forced the government to delay its nuclear energy plans. TEPCO officials said earlier it found a small amount of radiation in a pool of water below a network of control rods, but stressed no radiation had escaped into the outside environment. Public anger after several major accidents at nuclear facilities over the past 5 years in Japan, including Japan's worst ever accident last September that killed two uranium plant workers, has forced delays in the government's nuclear program. This news from Thurmont, Maryland. The Camp David peace talks are at a crossroads. President Clinton is deciding whether the summit of Israeli and Palestinian leaders should go on. Clinton rejoined the talks last night after returning to the United States from Japan. Upon his return to Camp David, Clinton went straight into meetings with the U.S. team, followed by meetings with the Israeli and Palestinian leaders. Officials have indicated that the president's decision on whether it is worthwhile to continue the Mideast summit will be based largely on those talks. As the talks enter the 14th day, the main point of dispute remains Jerusalem, the holy city claimed by both Israel and Palestinians as their capital. Cyber snooping is in the spotlight on Capitol Hill today. A House panel is taking a closer look at an FBI email surveillance program called Carnivore. The system monitors suspected criminals' email. It's installed at a suspect's internet provider and scans through all incoming and outgoing mail looking for messages belonging to the suspect. Privacy groups and some lawmakers are raising objections. They worry that Carnivore infringes on the rights of innocent people who are not under investigation. One ACLU official says the program represents a serious threat to the privacy of all Americans. Colombia's second largest rebel group, the National Liberation Army, known as the ELN, began peace talks with the government and civil and religious leaders today against the backdrop of deadly clashes in Latin America's longest-running conflict. Leaders of Colombia's National Liberation Army vowed to work toward peace after nearly four decades of rebellion as they met Government Peace Commissioner Camilo Gomez and several dozen civil society leaders for 2 days of talks at a Geneva hotel. Little is expected to come out of the talks, which follow bloody clashes last week between rebels and Colombia's main right-wing paramilitary force in two remote areas of the Andes Mountains in which up to 100 people were killed. There's also been no progress in the government's peace talks with Colombia's largest rebel group, the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. White defendants in federal capital cases are more likely than blacks to negotiate plea bargains that spare their lives. This, according to an analysis of 146 cases prosecuted since Congress reinstated capital punishment. 60% of white defendants avoided capital punishment through a negotiated settlement in cases in which the Justice Department chose to pursue the death penalty. Typically, those plea bargains result in either life sentences or long prison terms. For black defendants in those cases, 41% reached an agreement with prosecutors. This, according to the Federal Death Penalty Resource Council Project, a private group that receives federal funding to track federal capital cases. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Last week, the British government announced it had found no evidence that Iraq had used chemical weapons against British troops in the Gulf War. A study published by the British Ministry of Defense said there had been alarms about chemical attacks during the 1990-91 conflict, but they had proved to be false ones. Many British former Allied servicemen have suffered debilitating illnesses dubbed Gulf War Syndrome since the war, but researchers now think it's more likely due to vaccines they were given rather than exposure to chemical weapons. Another study was released last week, or at least a senior UN official said on Friday, about 500,000 children under the age of five have died in Iraq since the imposition of UN sanctions 10 years ago. Anupama Rao Singh, the country director for the UN Children's Fund, known as UNICEF, made the estimate in an interview with Reuters. She said, in absolute terms, we estimate perhaps about 500,000 children under five have died who ordinarily would not have died had the decline in mortality that was prevalent over the 70s and 80s continued through the 90s. UNICEF survey published in August showed the mortality rate among Iraqi children under five had more than doubled in the government-controlled south and center of Iraq during the sanctions. We're joined right now by the Honorable George Galloway, British Member of Parliament, Senior Vice Chair of the Parliamentary Labour Party Foreign Affairs Committee. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, you are deeply involved with British policy towards Iraq and actually are opposed to it. Can you talk about what that policy is and why you're opposed?
Well, this has been going on now for 10 years. It is one of the greatest crimes of the 20th century, and it's now spilled over into the 21st. The statistic you gave of doubling of child mortality, more than 500,000 dead children, I have to tell you is a serious underestimate. The real figure is probably 1 million or more children under five, and then when you add all the others, Britain and America, for it is a British and American policy, are responsible for killing more Iraqis than Pol Pot killed Cambodians in the killing fields of the genocide of 20 years ago in Cambodia. This is an appalling atrocity. The sanctions are themselves a weapon of mass destruction. You talked earlier about the demolition of yet another myth, namely that Iraq had used chemical weapons during the Gulf War, and if it didn't use them, as the British now say, during the Gulf War, why would they be threatening or likely to use them now when, according to the United Nations' own officials, Scott Ritter, the American Marine, and even Richard Butler, the former head of the UNSCOM, have said that the vast majority of Iraq's military capacity has long ago been destroyed. So an Iraqi child is dying every 6 minutes of every day and night, of every week, of every month, of every year for 10 years. That's quite a mass grave. It's a mass grave unprecedented since the Holocaust. And these Iraqis are dying before they even know that they are Iraqis. But they're dying, indisputably, only because they are Iraqis. And that, to me, is a crime. It's immoral. It's illegal. And lastly, of course, it's ineffective, because if this policy was about bringing down the Iraqi regime, there isn't a single commentator anywhere who thinks that that is a likely outcome, who thinks that if we just kill some more Iraqi children, the Iraqi regime will fall. In fact, the regime is stronger now, internally, than it was before this policy began. So a policy which is immoral, illegal, and ineffective seems to me like a policy that needs to be changed. But the problem is here in the United States and in my country, Great Britain. And this is a very real shame on us. It's all being done in our name and using our taxes.
We're talking to the Honourable George Galloway, British Member of Parliament. Talk about the Mariam Fund and what it is you've established in Britain.
Well, we brought a small Iraqi child who was suffering from leukemia. Her name was Mariam Hamza. We brought her to Britain in a blaze of largely hostile publicity 2 and a bit years ago. And she was a little angel with a holy name who demonstrated at a glance that Iraqis are people just like you and me, and that with children just like you and me, and their children bleed if we cut them just like our children bleed. And here was a bleeding Iraqi child, not the Iraqi president, because, of course, Western policy has sought to reduce Iraq from 22 million people to one person, and then to demonize that one person to the extent that any crime is thereafter acceptable. Here was a small bleeding child who touched the hearts of many people, not just in the UK, but around the world. So we, by the grace of God, restored her to health, sent her back to her family in Baghdad, and she's doing quite well now. But of course, the vast majority of children who were in hospital with her at the time have perished, as indeed the children are perishing at the rate of one every 6 minutes ever since. But one of the things I'm here in the US to promote is a project in her name, in the Mariam Appeal name, for international work brigades to go to Iraq from May of next year, 1 month-long brigades, who will attempt reconciliation through reconstruction to try and help build a friendship village in Iraq, an international friendship village, which will say to the Iraqi people and the Iraqi children that they are not hated by ordinary Americans, ordinary British people, or ordinary people from around the world, that because our governments have committed a crime against them does not mean that we are filled with any kind of hatred towards them. And we want to help rebuild Iraq as an act of reconciliation. So one of the things I'm here to do is to promote an American participation in those international work brigades. And I'm on a speaking tour of 7 American cities, in which I will be trying to say that this Anglo-American policy has to be changed because it is a real crime and we're involved in it.
What do people in Britain understand about what's happening in Iraq? I mean, a couple things. The U.S.-British bombing of Iraq when they say Iraq violates the no-fly zones is not imposed by the United Nations. It's imposed by these two countries, yours, Britain, and ours, the United States. What do people think is happening?
Well, as you correctly say, there is absolutely no legal basis for these no-fly zones. So, in fact, Britain and America are flying illegal military missions over Iraq without any shred of international legal justification. And, of course, Iraq is not breaking the terms of the so-called no-fly zones in the sense that it's not flying. The British and American airplanes bomb Iraq every other day, killing innocent people. I mean, there's not a single recorded instance of one of the Iraqi leadership being bombed. The ordinary shepherd, his family, The poor people living on the edges of towns in the slum areas, they're the ones who are being bombed by high-tech Western arms. And they never did any harm to anybody. They didn't commit any crime of any kind. Iraq is not flying in the no-fly zones. What happens, according to the military top brass, and you can take it, I think, with a pinch of salt, is that Iraq fastens whatever is left of its radar onto these aeroplanes, and in retaliation for which, a devastating blizzard of high explosives is rained down on largely innocent civilian targets. I must, having been there and seen these things in action, I don't believe even that the radar is being switched on. I think this is a low-level war of attrition, which continues to kill Iraqis and continues to demonstrate Anglo-American power. And for what? It's solving nothing. It played a key role in diverting attention from Bill Clinton's peccadilloes at various times of his recent trials and tribulations. But it certainly didn't do anything to bring democracy to the Middle East or to support human rights in Iraq or to further any noble, worthwhile, or legal cause. And we're very close to Bill Clinton's policy. If we got any closer, Clinton would be inviting us into the back office. And I think that's a deeply degrading place for Britain to be. And that's why I'm one of the campaigners in Britain trying to force a break with what is a US-led policy.
Do you see any change over the last decade?
Well, the change in Iraq has been all to the worse. Iraq was a largely secular and very tolerant society within its internal cohesion, the position of women, for example, the subservience of religion to secular politics, the tremendous advance in health and education which Iraqi people had made. They were on the brink of first world status so far as all these measurements were concerned. All of that has gone now. Religious fundamentalism is out and running in Iraq. Women are back into black robes and hiding themselves, not least because they don't have any other clothes or any other ability to get a hairdo, or all the things that women used to do in Iraq are now impossible. Children are sitting on the floor of schools where the sewage is running openly in the corridors.
But in terms of British policy, do you see any change? And what about the level of grassroots activism?
Well,
I
think
now
there's a terrific advance, both in Britain and America, of the anti-sanctions movement. Here in the U.S., people like Ramsey Clark and others have been for 10 years pushing at this, and I think they're now getting somewhere. In Britain, too, we have made a number of breakthroughs. What I say is this: we're a minority, but we're not a small minority. And the best of the British people are with us, the religious people, the left, the trade unions, the intellectuals, people with an internationalist perspective have long ago come to the conclusion that this policy is a disastrous failure. And one which, moreover, I come from the place where Pinochet was recently banged up for crimes that he committed decades ago. Frankly, British and American leaders are complicit in real crimes. One day, somebody will hit them with a writ for all these Iraqi children that their policy has have killed. And they know, because of the United Nations surveys and things that you were quoting earlier, they know their policy is killing innocent children. That's a crime in anybody's language.
Finally, where are you going in the United States?
I'm going to Houston, to Dallas, San Antonio, to Washington on the 5th and 6th of August, where there's a major big demonstration and a whole weekend of activities around the 10th anniversary. Then I'm going on to Detroit, where I understand there are quite considerable numbers of Iraqi Americans living. And I'm speaking at public meetings and engagements in all of these places. And I'll come back any time that I can to try and heighten awareness of this terrible crime which is being done in our name.
Do you have allies in the U.S. Congress?
Yes, there are a number of American congressmen, David Bonnier, Conyers. David Bonnier coined a phrase which actually sums up this whole point, that we have a policy of infanticide masquerading as politics. That's a very devastating quotation, and I think it's something that Americans should listen to.
The Honorable George Galloway, British Member of Parliament, has come to this country to speak about U.S. and British policy towards Iraq. The conference that you mentioned this weekend, which will culminate in a rally in Washington on Sunday, among the groups involved with that is Voices in the Wilderness. Kathy Kelly, its founder in Basra now, to live there with a number of other Americans, as ordinary Iraqis do, to experience what U.S. foreign policy and British foreign policy has done. The group Voices in the Wilderness, their number is 773-784-8065. That's 773-784-8065 to find out about this weekend's activities of a national conference and rally in Washington, D.C. on the anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, the rally taking place on August 6th. George Galloway, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, a journey into what it is to be Maori. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend, I spent a few days in New Mexico. Our listeners on Friday heard the broadcast from KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where we took a tour of nuclear New Mexico. After I left Albuquerque that morning, I went to Santa Fe in the north of New Mexico, and the next day headed to Los Alamos, where the atomic bomb was created close to more than 55 years ago. And I had the chance to speak with and listen to Hinevirengi Kohu Morgan, who is a Maori artist, poet, and activist. She was brought to New Mexico by the Lannan Foundation. And she talked about what it meant to come to New Mexico, this nuclear land, from a land, New Zealand, what the Maori people call Aotearoa, which has fought against nuclear experiments and nuclear testing in her area. The Olympics are coming up in Sydney, and Aboriginal people will be out in force in Australia to protest the racist treatment of Australia. New Zealand next door has similar tension because the Maori say they have not been respected as the original population of New Zealand. Hinevirengi brings that message all over the world. She's a board member of the International Indian Treaty Council and a representative for the nuclear-free and independent Pacific Movement. In addition, she's organized and hosted numerous indigenous people's conferences around the world. For the past 20 years, Hinevirengi has served as founding director of the Maori Women's Center, instituting programs that help end domestic violence and rebuild community while promoting radical changes in the dominant political and economic system. I ask you now to sit back and listen to Hinevirengi Kohu Morgan.
I first of all greet the Atua, the gods and goddesses of my own land, and then acknowledge that and couple that with the people of this land. Karangamaira! 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 E te whenu, tangata whenu, a tēnā koutou! Tēnā koutou! Tēnā koutou! E mari ahau te aroha o ngā iwi o Aotearoa kia koutou I tēnei pō! Tēnā koutou! Tēnā koutou! Tēnā koutou! I want to take you on a journey tonight. And I have 45 minutes to do it in. But I want to take you on a journey of what it is to be Māori. I want to take you back in a time when my people lived in Hawaiki Nui, Hawaiki Roa, Hawaiki Pāmama. It's in Pāhia terms or in European terms, it's called pre-colonisation. Do you know what the meaning of colonisation is? See, in Māori, we have this distinct way of breaking down words because they mean things in our reo, in our language. And speaking English, I sometimes forget, so remind me that I haven't translated the word. But colonisation, you know, it's like I try to teach our people the meaning of colonisation and what that means. We'll get to that point soon, but I want you to think about it during this time while I take you on this beautiful journey first, pre-colonisation. But if we broke it down, and I try to teach my people, okay, break the word down, because we're not dumb. Neither are we, you know how they have that in colonisation, that insane idea that we actually don't know anything as native people or as indigenous peoples. But we have the power to save the world and save you. But if we broke the word down, colonisation, the only real part of that base root word is colon. And you can answer yourself about what the meaning of colon means, you know? And so when my people understood it in that way, we decolonised very quickly. I want to take you back into a time when my people, and they still are, pre that time. And what we had in place so many things that would help not just ourselves, but the world. And globally, we had to think about that. Everybody in our society has a role. We have a role, everyone. We thought as family. We thought as tribal peoples. We thought never as an individual. We had no understanding of what that meant, that we could get better than the other. And it was in a very, very old time. And very many of those I still uphold in the terms of reteaching our people how to decolon. And so one of the journeys that I want to take you on is a beautiful journey of my people. And don't get mixed up with romanticism as opposed to who we are. And what often happens for people, they get romantic about what it is to be Māori. We fought. We were angry with one another. We had all the wars that we had. And, of course, it was all about our little areas. And, it's you know, we did all of those rotten things when we were in that time. But we also had very strong aroha bonds that bind us very strong together as a family, as family members. Our elders were our teachers. And why? And not all of our elders, you know, because a lot of our elders were really naughty, what we call kurikuri, right? And they still didn't accept aged. They might have been 60 physically, but they were only 6 spiritually and every other way. But our elders were our teachers, and they had a role of looking after the children. All the children. See, we didn't have an idea of nuclear families. We had ideas about, just because you were the biological mother doesn't mean a thing in Māori society. We lived in clusters. We lived in together on what we call papakainga. We lived together as families so that there was no such thing as violence to children, child abuse. Because, you know, the parents were well-rested because the kuia karaua, the elders, took over. And you had no say in the matter, really, because it was their job to watch the children, and they taught us rhythm. Believe it or not, we got rhythm as old people. We're wonderful. And the rhythm of the kōhatu was a really important... Tagiri, 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 mahi, amai, nganga, mai, ko e rua, he wai, hine, pune, un, kua, te pu, te hue, hue, papai, raro, turai, ko e, tagiri, 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 hey. And we had to learn rhythm. And no child was without the kohatu, or the stone. And these are just stone, and they were able to choose and make those stones, and learned rhythm from our kuia karaua. From the elders. We were taught how to sing. We sang when we learned. We never had a written language. That came with the missionaries. We were oral people. But, you know, the arrogance of English that think they have to have this written word. Well, we did too. Because as you look at design, they tell stories. They are our storybooks. Our houses are filled with the stories, our carvings are filled, and they were our major storybooks, and what we learnt from our elders was how to read the stories. And if we couldn't read them, then they made us learn them through song. And we learnt well. And we were singing people, powerful, strong, and beautiful. And we'd have no other tell us any differently. I am fat, I am proud, and I'm beautiful, and I'm stunning and tough if you don't think so. Because I do. Yeah. I don't fit the English size of women, but who cares? I don't want to be their size. You know, the wind will blow them over like that. I'll bounce. What I learned in those traditional times, and I lived traditionally with my mother and father and our family cluster. My mother came from a family of 15. My father from a family of 21, of which he was the youngest. I come from a family of 12, of which I'm the eldest of the eldest of the eldest woman. I learned pride in where I began. And I began prior to choosing my mother. I learned the pride of womanhood and understood the beauty of being a co-creator with the atua. And in our language, people, we don't have a sexist, we have a non-sexist language, you know. We don't have a him and a her. We have ko iaia, ko iaia, ko iaia, which means we address the male-female within each and every one of us. And on our left side is taha wahine, the female essence, and on our right side is our male essence. And we address ko iaia, ko iaia, ko iaia. So when I greet you, I greet the male and the female that lives within. And sometimes, and for the last few years of my life, I've been very male. Because I have to get male now and then. But I don't lose my female either. And I don't, because this journey of holding my female is really, really strong. And it does this kind of thing. E re re ra te mata ni ki wa ho to ranga ke re ra ra ko e hi Te aro hati anei Mauria mai taku aro oha Tawhiti pa mama Kereira ra ko e hine te I live as a woman. I practice as a woman. I am. And when you talk about loving, it comes from deep within. And it comes from my ancestors. Because I am of the genealogy of a chiefess. I am from one of the two matriarchal tribes that exist in Aotearoa. You don't muck around with people like me. It's simple. And they know it. At home, they know it. That's why I wear this. So I wear this. And that's why I wear it on my arm. It is because it's my mark. And it was put there by my father and my elders. And I didn't want it because I was a spoiled, rotten mokopuna, or grandchild. I want to take you on the power of that trip of being wahine, being woman. And it's not, because I also want to take you on the trip of being male. I have a wonderful male side to me, and that meets and matches quite well. Doesn't matter where I am. Even with Lizzie, you know, Lizzie's the Queen of England. I couldn't give a damn if I had to tell her to get. In the wahine, in the woman, we have what we call the whare tangata. And you have to understand that the whare tangata is, whare means house. Tangata means humanity. So all of you have had to pass through the whare tangata at one stage or other. Some come early, some come late. Right? Every one of us have had to experience the warmth of that house that we carry as wahine. And in our teachings and in our learning, we learn the beautiful concept of entering a beautiful... Just imagine this, for instance. You're entering the whare tangata as a little spirit from the atua, from the gods and goddesses, and this is how we picture how we do it. And as you enter that whare then, as a spirit being, everything in there moves around, doesn't it? The furniture. Wahine, woman, look at yourselves and know, as a mother, just how everything that was there prior to that little one coming to visit for 9 months has had to move around. The furniture has had to move in this house. And it does. It's an amazing thing. It's the most beautiful, amazing concept. You know, some of us just forgot to move the furniture back, you know, the waterbed, and it's dropped a little bit, but who cares? It's still nonetheless the whare tangata. And we see that as a concept, as a beautiful concept of wahine, in terms of co-creator with the atua, with the creator, the creators. I was born with that knowledge. I came into this culture by choice, and I understood my mother's whare tangata. And I was rested and warm within that. But my mother needed to be loved too and kept sacred. And in those sacred times, the elders or the kuia, not the Q-U-E-E-R, but the K-U-I-A, the older women, came and they took care. And it was the most beautiful time because we understood our time in being with the marama. Whiti te marama I te po. Ti aho iho mai koe, he karu mo te mata o te pō, he karu mo te mata o te pō. It was talking about the moon. We have a relationship with the moon. We came with that. We understood when we reached Aotearoa, which is the land of the long white cloud named by the wife of our great navigator, Kupe. And it is Aotearoa, land of the long white cloud. And, you know, just sort of sidetracking a little bit because I'm great at that, because I'm Indigenous and we can do that, eh? Don't we? We walk over there for a minute and I'll bring you back to the point. But land of the long, when I was asked by a Japanese about what my name of my country was, I said Aotearoa, and he asked me what it meant. And I told him, land of the long white cloud. And you know, Japanese, they can't spell, they can't do their R's and their L's. And so he says, ah, land of the wrong white crowd. And I went, That is so prophetic. I didn't want to believe he could not do his R's and his L's. I just was thinking that was the most prophetic thing. But nonetheless, we came with the knowledge of our atua, of our gods and goddesses, and how we're pantheist in a Pākehā sense, in an English sense. But we knew and we came intact with our religious worship. When we talk about the Earth Mother, we talk about Papatūānuku. And we talk about the Sky Father, and we talk about Ranginui. And we know that, you know, Europeans like to write these books about myths and legends. Well, it ain't a myth that we know that the Earth is our mother. And it's not about mother, a myth. You know, they want to define everything for us and talk about it as a myth, and to myth it is to, actually, they're the greatest myth to me, but I try to be kind, and I try very hard. It's quite impossible sometimes, but it's not a myth about how we know. We have intrinsic knowledge that acknowledges the earth as our mother, that acknowledges the sky as our father. And in between our sky mother, our earth, in between that all, we know of 70 sons being born between the earth mother and the sky father.
You're listening to Hine Virangi, Kohu Morgan, a Maori artist, poet, and activist, speaking this weekend in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And we'll come back to this speech by a representative for the Nuclear Free and Independent Pacific Movement, board member of the International Indian Treaty Council, in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
E tui hone Papatūānuku I takoto mai Ko te parika rangaranga Te wahine a kupe A te
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Hine Virangi Kohu Morgan, Maori artist, poet, and activist, speaking in New Mexico this past weekend.
It's not a myth about how we know. We have intrinsic knowledge that acknowledges the earth as our mother, that acknowledges the sky as our father. And in between our sky mother, our earth... In between that all, we know of 70 sons being born between the earth mother and the sky father. And we had to ask ourselves as women, how come there's only 71 sons? There was no other woman born. And it's a simple answer, because women were already in place. And you know what? Scientifically, when you're born, until you've had the androgen bath within, which is an internal bath, you are born female. And you can argue the point, but don't argue with the scientists, don't argue with me. There's some things I really want to believe about them, and there's some things I just track out. We came knowing our relationship with everything to Aotearoa. We came understanding what it is to be in the ocean, because we're ocean navigators. Hoi a ra te wakane, hoi a hoi a ki te pae. Mā te hoi a karawhiu, kia re re tīkara.
te wakane, hoia hoia ki te pai, ma te hoia karapu, kia re re tikara, kia re re tikara. And it kept us in rhythm as we came across the oceans and we traversed the Polynesian Triangle. To Rapa Nui, that everybody calls Easter Island. God. It's an ancient place. And we know the Mo'ai. We speak the same language. We know. I speak 7 languages of the Polynesian Triangle. And they try to tell me I'm illiterate. They stuck me in a dyslexic class because my language wasn't English. They punished me for speaking Māori. But I tell you something, the beauty lays within the language. And I advocate that strongly. And I teach it in Waiata, in creative arts, and anything that I can help my people to make change. I want to share with you a writing from Kanohi ki te Kanohi. They're out there for sale, you know. They're for our women's community. And I write, but you know, you don't get rich on writing because you have to actually give all that money to your marae, which is great. It just keeps me intact. It keeps me from being an individual. It keeps me intact. But part of that, I'm wanting to bring you and tell you on this journey that we came from a very strong and beautiful culture, knowing who we were and knowing our relationship to the papa. Knowing our relationship to the ocean, knowing our relationship to the sky, knowing our relationship to the forests, knowing our relationships to the rivers, the lakes, and understanding how infinitely small we are, because those things are our elders, which is why in my mihi, I will mihi to the mountain first. I will greet the mountains, I will greet the lakes, I will greet... Because even in the English people, you know, when they read their Bible, it says they were the last to be born. It tells you that everything else was created, so then everything else is the elder and we are the taina. But somehow we've twisted it around a little bit, some of us. I certainly know that I haven't. I'm bringing you to a place of colonization. Now remember, I asked you to remember that colon word? And how to define it? I'll define it for you because somehow a great deal of academics want to define cultural freedom for me. And I think, oh, okay. Where are you writing from? I remember that Janet, and I want to tell her the story, but it's just so funny. She sent me a beautiful paper on cultural, defending cultural traditions, right? I had the greatest fun you could ever had. I had about 5 of our women who were there to see me off, and I said, now I've got to understand this. You've got to help me understand this and what this is saying, because, boy, if she asked me, have I read it, I better have tried. And so I began the reading of this very academic definition of in defense of cultural traditions, you know. And the woman was sitting around, and I knew what I was doing. I was really, it was me having a bit of fun. And the blurb was on the top, and I began to read. But I had to hold the paper up and like this, and I'm reading so they couldn't see me. And every now and then I'd peek over the top, and they'd be like, what? What that mean? And it was just really funny. And I come to define my own sense of in defense of cultural traditions, right? The one thing that I before reading this piece is, I just want to tell you that we don't, in Māori traditions, blow our own trumpets to say that I'm a healer, I'm a this, I'm a that. I'm just Tēnu Irangi. And I want you to know that. I thank Patrick for all of that, but somebody else wrote it for me because I couldn't write it, Patrick. And I couldn't write that. But this is what I write, and I want to share this with you. I'm leading you into a point of the arrival of of Britain. And you have to know the tools of colonization. You have to know them. It's called the Bible, the bullet, and the bullshit. Three B's. Three B's. And they still all, absolutely, though we laugh at them, they're powerful tools. Because they have taken a lot of our people into Christianity. And we need to be looking at traditional ways. And we can't mix Christianity with our traditional ways, and I'll tell you why. Because the Christians say, thou shalt have no other gods before me, for I, the Lord God, am a jealous God. Yeah? So can my belief in the Earth Mother, a goddess, and my belief in the Sky Father, a god, fit into that? No, it doesn't. It really doesn't if we truly look at the Christian influence in our lives. So I bring our people back to Papa and Rangi. And this is why. This is called Kuru. It's grandfather. Grandfather, speak to me of being woman. When a child, grandmother taught magical lessons, Mother Earth, Papa Tuanuku, nurturing, caring, loving my brothers, my sisters, my mothers, my fathers, sacred circle of family, of whānau, eternal flame, ahika, growing inside of warmth, safety, loving my sisters, growing deep within mother's breast, brothers, te wao nui o tāne, the great forests, whānau inhabiting the forest floor. Family, winged children of rangi nui e tū iho nei, birthing woman lessons from all whānau, glowing in woman's light, nā kuia grandmothers. Kōrero, talk. Kōro wind, his songs of anger, peace, gentle, caressing, kissing, licking my paparinga, my cheeks. Four directions, ngā haue whā. His thundering messages flashing, skies, colouring pages of my mind, child mind. My beauty, my rain, my roimata, my tears. Warm in my sleep, words tapping on tin roof. Grandmother moon, radiant light, gifts, light in my night, a road to walk through my nights. Te awa o te tangata, the river of humanity. In my marama, my moon, red flows from within full womanhood. She speaks of global beauty, life's circle complete, honouring fathers, brothers, uncles, sons, completeness. Grandmother moon, birthing mother lessons, listening to our baby, growing deep within, teaching those lessons, sacred houses. Tapu time, sacred time. But fear, anger, hate, strangers lost to their own roots, different ways, progress, technology, white collar, destroying sacred houses, removing language, removing rituals, gods and goddesses, come calling me barbaric, savage, native, Māori. They need to have power over raping, violating, killing, destroying my people, my nation, invaders, savage invaders, dancing technological fire dances, clouded minds of dope, chemicals, crack, cocaine, heroin, dancing alcoholic dances, plastic horses spinning faster and faster into a life of death. Barbarians of the Western Seas practice genocide, winning, losing, betting games, lust, power, for power, tools of the stranger, babies unborn dance chemical death songs, death does not come, plastic bubbles, home of the dying, babies survive, born into chemical hate. E kuru, grandfather, am I supposed to love the strangers? So many questions, love, hate, love, hate, love, hate. I hear your song, Ma. I hear your song, grandmother. I have just to remember the words and savour the taste of them on my lips. The words fade into wairua, spirit. Life then becomes bearable. Stillness enters my soul, begins to fly. I will not be lulled into the mystical, trendy Eastern Western religion, but I will stay close to the Wairua, to the spirit of the ancient ones. Knowing I have survived, I will survive. I hear your prayers, old ones. These songs that enter my heart will sing. I remember those prayers. I remember that I am woman. I am Maori. I am man. I am grandmother. I am grandfather. I am light and darkness. Sparkling newness comes. Old voices, old wairua, old wisdoms, remember, renewed, live within me. For I am old, wise, and powerful, and I am woman. Tera taku wakako mata tuaka u ki te taira whiti ki ngā kuri o whare ki te kirau. E hoi a e puhi ke te tai toke rau ki hoki a ngā whakapau karakia kei reira nā pui, kei reira tera rawa. Ka hoki na e o ki te taira whiti ko kaua e tangoi kei te kaho te tini o tūkā ki kei tō rerenu ko ngai tai. Kei o maru motu ko tau tā mure, kei o pō tiki mau ngā pō hat, tū hoi pō tiki mau mau kai, he mau mau taonga, mau mau taonga tai te pō e. Ka hoke nei au ki te taira piti whake, kei au i rangi taike, kia rangi he ua, kia ngai te awa, kei runga te kōreo, kei raro te rahura, kia mihi au ki te manuka tūtahi kūrei tangara o mā tātua. Ki te kuhi a muriwa, whakahau wake nei ka whakatāne, au i a hau. Kia pārora whakaea, whakaea na mai, koe he wiri wiri, pūkanaka na mai, koe he tani, whakanaka na mai, koe he parupa, upoko kohua tamataku e. Ka hoki nei au ki te taira, whiti ko taurangara, ko ngai te rangi, ko ngai te rangi, ko ngā pāpakauranga tau. Mai whareroa ki maunga tapu, putanoa ki te rere a tūkāhe, ko tauranga mō ana tauranga tangata ki raru ki tai e. We came into colonisation fighting, what we lost, and you heard it all when I spoke to the elders, said that I would know what my road would be. I was angry, and I had to learn to sing to myself in order to deal with my anger. We're allowed to deal with anger in Māori society. We get up there and we do the haka, just like I did. Ka kamate, kamate! And we're allowed to sing. We're allowed to go out there and be noisy. And let our anger and our pain and our hurt out. I teach our children to cry. You know, I raised 15 children in colonization. I was the greatest thief you could ever know. I had to be. Try raising 15 children in a society. It's not going to help you. They were all kicked out anyway. These children came from places of dope and cocaine, crack. These children came from suicidal places. These children came from all over, and most of them were under 6.
Hine Virangi, Kohu Morgan, Maori activist, artist, poet, speaking this weekend in Santa Fe, New Mexico, flown in by the Lannan Foundation. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill. We had help today from Deepa Fernandez and Nell Geiser. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Take